We'll be looking at several passages in the Old Testament this evening, and a few different references to passages in Hosea. For our reading, we'll read together chapter 4 of Hosea. Hosea chapter 4, where the charge comes to Israel. Last week we were considering how Israel's idolatry was, in a sense, its spiritual adultery. And that lies behind the lived-out parable between Hosea and the wife he was commanded to take, some fickle wife, Gomer. And so now, having given us the parable, so to speak, Hosea delivers the charge from God against Israel directly. And where you see imagery that has to do with marriage and infidelity, for that idolatry and spiritual infidelity. Hear the word of the Lord, you Israelites, because the Lord has a charge to bring against you who live in the land. There is no faithfulness, no love, no acknowledgement of God in the land. There is only cursing, lying, and murder, stealing, and adultery, which there perhaps means the real thing. They break all bounds, and bloodshed follows bloodshed. Because of this, the land mourns, and all who live in it waste away. The beasts of the field, and the birds of the air, and the fish of the sea are dying. But let no man bring a charge, let no man accuse another. For your people are like those who bring charges against the priest. You stumble day and night, and the prophets stumble with you. So I will destroy your mother. My people are destroyed from lack of knowledge. Because you have rejected knowledge, I also reject you as my priests. Here we see a direct word, not just to the people, but now particularly to the priests. Because you have ignored the law of your God, I will also ignore your children. The more the priests increased, the more they sinned against me. They exchange their glory for something disgraceful. They feed on the sins of my people and relish their wickedness. And it will be like people, like priests. I will punish both of them for their ways and repay them for their deeds. They will eat but not have enough. They will engage in prostitution but not increase. Because they have deserted the Lord and given themselves to prostitution, to old wine and new, which take away the understanding of my people. They consult a wooden iron and are answered by a stick of wood. The spirit of prostitution leads them astray, and they are unfaithful to their God. They sacrifice on the mountaintops and burn offerings on the hills and the whole poplar and terebinth where the shade is planted. Therefore your daughters turn to prostitution and your daughters-in-law to adultery. I will not punish your daughters when they turn to prostitution, nor your daughters-in-law when they commit adultery, because the men themselves consort with harlots and sacrifice at the temple of prostitutes. A people without understanding will come to ruin. For you commit adultery, O Israel, let not Judah become guilty. Do not go to Gilgal, do not go up to Bethlehem, and do not swear as surely as the Lord lives. The Israelites are stubborn, like a serpent. How then can the Lord pasture them like the lambs in the meadow? Ephraim is joined to idols, leave him alone. Even when their drinks are gone, they continue their prostitution. Their rulers deal with love, shameful ways. The whirlwind will sweep them away, and their sacrifices will bring them shame. Amen. May God help us to understand what he is saying now, as well as then. Hosea, and to our second evening in Hosea, when we look at, not in particular chapter 4, but we look at some of the things that chapter 4 is pointing to. What we're quickly looking at is the way in which Israel, quote, played God false, departed from the law. Now, just a little quick recap on some of the history. The United 12 tribes, very early on, under the kingship of King Rehoboam, split. 10 tribes went to the north under Jeroboam, who was an exceedingly wicked king. And those 10 tribes are called Israel. Occasionally, in this letter, they're called Ephraim. We read that in verse 17, for instance, of chapter 4. Now, their capital was the city of Samaria, and their first king was Jeroboam I. The other two tribes stayed in the south, centered on Jerusalem, under King Rehoboam, and they're usually called Judah, although the tribe of Benjamin also stayed with them. So, Judah and Benjamin in the south, Israel or Ephraim up in the north. Now, Judah in the south eventually had departed so far from God that they went into exile. What was, by and large, a slow and gradual decline in Judah was a catastrophic collapse in Israel in the north. Under King Jeroboam, within months of that alliance of 10 tribes being formed in the north, within months, they had jettisoned most of what God had taught the people as a whole. For instance, in Exodus and in Deuteronomy, before the 12 tribes went into the land, and what God had said to them through their leaders since then. With a quite astonishing rapidity, they threw off all that had been to them onerous and burdensome about following God single-mindedly, wholeheartedly. In itself, it is a lesson that though people seem faithful and seem diligent and seem to be going on with Christ, it happens in the Christian life that with sometimes quite astonishing speed, people, particularly if they break away from fellowship with other Christians, can just seem to jettison the whole thing. And in a very short time, spiritually speaking, can be nowhere. Well, it happened with Israel. Jeroboam, in 931 BC, who was the king, started a whole collapse of spiritual life in Israel. I want to read you a little bit, don't bother turning it up, from 1 Kings chapter 12 and from verse 25 there. This is the story immediately after the split. Then Jeroboam fortified Shechem in the hill country of Ephraim and lived there. From there he went out and built Peniel. Jeroboam thought to himself, to ask ourselves, what right is Jeroboam thinking? He has to think things like this to himself. Jeroboam thought to himself, the kingdom is now likely to revert to the house of David. If these people go up to offer sacrifices at the temple of the Lord in Jerusalem, they will again give their allegiance to their Lord, Rehoboam, king of Judah. They will kill me and return to King Jeroboam. Now Jerusalem is a place that God had said time and time again in the book of Deuteronomy, they were to go up to, it wasn't called Jerusalem, it was going to be the place where my name would dwell. For centralized worship, to hold the nation together. Here is Jeroboam realizing that that would happen, realizing that was a strength of worship in Jerusalem, and immediately chipping away at the people's spiritual relationship with God. After seeking advice, the king made two golden calves, echoes of Aaron and the children of Israel at the foot of Sinai. He said to the people, it is too much for you to go to Jerusalem in that night to come to Jerusalem. Hear your gods, O Israel, who brought you out of Egypt. One he set up in Bethel, the other in Dan. And this thing became a sin. The people went even as far as Dan to worship the one there, Dan where the north. Jeroboam built shrines on high places and appointed priests from all sorts of people, right against what God had been saying, even though they were not Levites. He instituted a festival on the 15th day of the 8th month, a festival to be given to the people by God. It's not up to Jeroboam to go making new festivals, like the festivals held in Judah, and offered sacrifices on the altar. That was not Jeroboam to do at all. as you did in Bethel, sacrificing to the calves he had made. And at Bethel he also installed priests at the high places he had made. On the 15th day of the 8th month, a month of his own choosing, he offered sacrifices up here. He offered sacrifices on the altar he had built in Bethel. So he instituted the festival for the Israelites and went up to the altar to make offerings. That was one of the first moves Jeroboam made in his new nation. What Jeroboam started in 1931 had run full course within the nation, within Israel. By the time that Hosea is prophesying in 750, somewhere around 750 to 722, it is the norm in Israel, to be constantly playing God false in the area of religion. So we find the description of what things are like by the time Hosea is prophesying in 1 in 2 Kings, chapter 17. An excellent, clear description of what the people are doing. Israel are exiled, and it says in 2 Kings 17, 7 following, all this took place because the Israelites had sinned against the Lord their God, who brought them out of Egypt from under the power of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. They worshipped other gods and followed the practices of the nations the Lord had driven out before them, as well as the practices which the kings of Israel had introduced. The Israelites secretly did things against the Lord their God that were not right. From watchtower to fortified city, they built themselves high places, these places to go and worship false gods, in all their towns. They set up sacred stones and Asherah poles, so sort of fertility-like things, on every high hill and under every spreading tree. At every high place they burned incense of the nations whom the Lord had driven out before them had done. They did wicked things that provoked the Lord to anger. They worshipped idols of the Lord and said, "You shall not do this." The Lord warned Israel and Judah through all his prophets and seers, "Turn away from your evil ways. Observe my commands and decrees in accordance with the entire law that I commanded your fathers to obey, that I delivered to you through my servants the prophets, but they would not listen. And they were as stiff-necked as their fathers who did not trust in the Lord their God. They rejected his decrees and the covenant he had made with their fathers and the warnings he had given them. They followed worthless idols and themselves became worthless. They imitated the nations around them, although the Lord had ordered them, do not do as they do. And they did the things the Lord had forbidden them to do. They forsook all the commands of the Lord their God and made for themselves two idols cast in the shape of calves and an Asherah pole. They bowed down to all the starry hosts and they worshipped Baal. They sacrificed their sons and daughters in the fire. They practiced divination and sorcery and sought themselves to do evil in the eyes of the Lord, provoking him to anger. So the Lord was very angry with Israel and removed them from his presence. Now that's what the people were up to in their religious life when Hosea came onto the scene. That's the situation. What had been supposedly the pure worship of Jehovah had become mixed and thoroughly infused and thoroughly confused with the worship of the old Canaanite gods, the Baals. They were the ones who were worshipped as being responsible for the harvest, for human fertility, for good livestock breeding, all those things. And mixed in with all that false worship or worship of false gods were some of the most detestable practices. Things that we might even balk at mentioning in church or anywhere. Things which the people ought never even to have been thinking. Practices that were so lewd and perverse and filthy that it makes you shrink away from them. Even when we're reading the word, which is so frank. In religion, the people departed from the Lord. Now, there are four particular ways in which the people have departed from the Lord in their religion, and I want just to tease them out a little. Because there are more parallels. Remember, Hosea is speaking to those who are God's people. This is Israel. This is part of this covenant nation. And the parallel now with Israel in chapter 8, verses 2 and 3 following, verses following in particular, and also in chapter 13, verse 13 of chapter 8, the first way in which they were playing God false is that he was Jehovah and their God in name only. He was their God in name only. Israel cries out to me, O our God, we acknowledge you, state two. O our God, we acknowledge you. But Israel has rejected what is good. An enemy will pursue him. Verse 13, they offer sacrifices given to me, but they eat meat. But the Lord is not pleased with them. Now he will remember their wickedness and punish their sins. Jehovah is their God in name only. In ordinary life, to all practical intents and purposes, he is not their God. They have his name. They have the semblances of religion. But like those that Paul warned Timothy about, they deny the power thereof. Their religion bears no relation to the rest of their living, because they have boxed Jehovah up very neatly, very simply, in their little box called church. There he is, almost like an aged relative that they would go and visit every now and then and be glad to get away from so they could have a good time. He was Jehovah to them, yes, but in name only. For all their religion, they were as hollow as blown names. Second, as well as only worshipping God in name, they worshipped all these other gods, these other idols that were in the land. We read a little about that last week, chapter 2, for instance, from the second half of verse 5 onwards. This is Israel, under the semblance of marital infidelity. She said, I will go after my lovers, the Baals, who gave me my food and my water, my wool and my linen, my oil and my drink. Therefore God says, I will block her path with thorn bushes. I will wall her in so that she cannot find her way. She will chase after her lovers but not catch them. She will look for them but not find them. Then she will say, I will go back to my husband as at first, that is Jehovah, for then I was better off than now. She has not acknowledged that I was the one who gave her the grain and new wine and oil, who lavished on her the silver and gold which they used to bear. There we have it in figurative language. We've already read about it in chapter 4. A stark description of what Israel was doing. Worshipping other gods and idols, in particular the Baals, and setting up these detestable, abominable practices. But the third thing, Jehovah, their God in name only, other gods and idols being worshipped by the people. The third thing was that their priesthood was corrupt. Their priesthood was corrupt. We read about it this evening in chapter 4 from verse 4 to 9. But let no man bring a charge, let no man accuse another, for your people are like those who bring charges against the priest. You stumble day and night, and the prophets stumble with you. So I will destroy your mother, my people will destroy you from lack of knowledge. Because you have rejected knowledge, I also reject you as my priests. Because you have ignored the Lord your God, I will also ignore your children. The more the priests increase, the more they sin against me. They exchange their glory, capital G as we have it in the International Version. That is basically they exchange me, Jehovah, who will be their glory, who will be their fullness, who will be the brilliance of the nation, who will be its splendor. They exchange their glory for something disgraceful. They feed on the sins of my people and relish their wickedness. And it will be my people like priests. I will punish both of them for their ways and repay them for their deeds. The priesthood was corrupt. What it is for the church and those who will lead its people, who will profess to lead the people in a congregation closer to God, are themselves utterly corrupted by the very things which hold their people back. Whether we look at that in doctrinal terms, whether we look at it in terms of behavior, What a thing when the people go without a shadow. When the people who need spiritual food are fed constantly. Or it is when people who need examples are given examples of all the wrong things. Priesthood was corrupt. There was no distinction whatsoever between the priests and the people and the nations around the land. And the fourth thing was that the religious rites were an abomination to God. They were detestable to God. The things that they were doing in the name of religion were throwing them, as it were, further and further away from God himself. So that God drew, in a sense, and we use this word advisedly, or I use it advisedly, God grew to detest the sight of his people. There was something about his own covenant people which God found utterly detestable. There was something about them which made him want to cut them off. In that lived out parable, one of the children born to Hosea and Gomer was called Lo-Ruhamah. Quotes, "For I will no longer show love to the house of Israel that I should at all forgive them." What a thought. What a thought for God himself to have to say to the people through Hosea, "The Lord has a charge to bring against you." What a picture of God standing over against those whom he has loved, those from whom he has every right to expect love and faithfulness and acknowledgement. He stands, as it were, over against them to bring a charge against them. We read all those words so quickly and so easily, but the immensity of what God has felt for his people, or towards them because of their sin, ought never to be lost upon us. Now those things have their modern counterparts. We have the modern counterpart of a kind of a nominalism. Nominalism even within the church, which loves all the incidentals. Did you notice that phrase? Verse 13 of chapter 4. They sacrifice on the mountaintops and burn offerings on the hills, under oak, poplar, and terebinth, where the shade is pleasant. It's a verse of the most savage sarcasm. The people find a nice, pleasant place, a pleasant tree and shade. And there's grass beneath. Oh, and it's lovely. What a pleasant place. What a nice place to see. And commit idolatry. The shade is so pleasant. Never mind whether we really hold any allegiance to God here. And never mind whether we really behave as if God is God. Never mind if we're really going to fulfill our covenant obligations to God. Stained glass windows can be so clean, where the place is so light, where the voice of the preacher can be so clean, where everything can be just hunky dory. And yet where the power of godliness is gone. In Jeremiah's time, as he was preaching in Jerusalem, roughly contemporary with Hosea, there was something of revival going on. Folk were flocking up to the temple again. It was great. You would have looked at the statistics and seen all the church growth programs and you thought, fantastic, what a great people. They're really now, they're on fire for God. And poor Jeremiah was charged with standing in front of his people and saying, "You're all wrong. You're all wrong. Because you're still living a corrupt life. And when you're not here, there's no difference between you and the demons. You say the temple, the temple, the temple. You say we go to church, we have a great time, it's lovely. Oh, what a nice young minister. I'm terribly thoroughly enjoying my children's events. I laughed my socks off through this morning. It was, well, I did. Oh, it's so nice, so nice. So sickening, banal, and false. This pathetic parody of Christianity. That God is not for you. It cuts no ice in the world. None whatsoever. Why should non-Christians, who are hard-headed, who very often are quite decisive and incisive in their perceptions, why should they be brought to something seemingly nominal and empty? Who can blame the vast, vast majority of our nation for not going into buildings full of banal, nice numbers where the windows are closed. In terms of religion, the nation played God false. And that's the foundation for the other two areas in which Israel was playing God false. And the main other one is the morality that springs from the religion. And now, I think we have to be quite grown up about things. There was a national preoccupation with what was sexual. There was a huge fascination with that which was forbidden, that which was, if you like, hidden. There was a sense in Israel that this is what life is all about. The pleasures of the flesh. Pleasures of the flesh. And is there a word more today than that? And remember, bear in mind all the time that was even speaking to the Old Testament church. Now, it's not just the license, it's not just the fuel of obsession that there was. Hosea has a fantastic image from God as he speaks to them. And he talks about these sinners, and he says they delight the kings with their wickedness, the princes with their lies. They're all adulterers, burning like an oven, whose fire the baker need not stir. From the kneading of the dough till it rises, there's this oven. There is this burning, hot license within the nation, which needs no stoking. It's just burning and burning away. It is a firestorm of immorality. You've known in the firestorms that came after some of the bombings in the Second World War in places like Dresden and Darmstadt. The very air itself seemed to burn. There was sufficient conflagration in a small area for it to start drawing all the air in as the hot air rose, and everything just started to burn. The buildings burst into flame quite spontaneously. People did the same. Roads melted. Everything just started burning. And you could see sheets of flame rolling down streets into firestorm. Now that is what was happening in Israel. It didn't need to be ignited anymore. It was just burning right out of control. Why? Partly because the people had given full rein to a human appetite gone wrong because of the fall. C.S. Lewis has an extremely interesting and amusing passage in New Christianity on the human appetite gone wrong, and I'll read you it just now. Charity is the most unpopular of the Christian virtues, there is no getting away from it. The Christian rule is either marriage with complete faithfulness to your partner, or else total abstinence. Now this is so difficult and so contrary to our instincts that I am obviously either Christianity is wrong, or our sexual instinct as it now is has gone wrong. One or the other. Of course, being Christian, I think it is the instinct which has gone so wrong. But I have other reasons for thinking so. The biological purpose of sex is true, just as the biological purpose of eating is to repair the body. Now, if we eat whenever we feel inclined and just as much as we want, it is quite true most of us will eat too much. I don't know if we go on a sponsored diet and strip trade, for example. But not terrifically too much. One man may eat enough for two, but he does not eat enough for 10. The appetite goes a little beyond its biological purpose, but not enormously. And if a healthy young man indulges sexual appetite whenever he felt inclined, and each act produces a baby, then in 10 years he might easily populate a small village. This appetite is a ludicrous and preposterous excess of its function. Or take it another way. You can get a large audience together for a strictly dance, that is, to watch a girl dress on stage. Now, suppose you come to a country where you can fill a theatre simply by bringing a covered plate onto the stage, and then slowly lifting the cover so as to let everyone see, just before the lights went out, that it contained a pork chop or a bit of bacon. Would you not think that in that country something had gone wrong with the appetite for food? Would we not think, and would not anyone who had grown up in a different world think that there was something equally queer about the state of the sex instinct among us? See, the people in Israel had given themselves completely over to something within themselves that they could not control, and it was controlled. Now that's the first thing that was sought in their morality. The actual things they were doing there in that particular area of life. But you see, the basis for their morality, and this is the even more insidious thing, the change. They were indulging in all these pleasures of the flesh because the basis of their morality had become themselves. They were accountable now, not to God. They were accountable only to their own desires. What I want to do had become the yardstick, had become the accountability within Israel, which yielded not only the problems with regard to sexuality, but it yielded also injustice, deceit, violence, theft, murder. You read about it in 4, 2, 6, 8, 7, 1, B, 7, chapter 7, verse 1, chapter 10, verse 4. It runs through so much else of what's written. You see, the shackles are off. The shackles are off. There are no absolutes anymore. There is no accountability. Everyone, as we read at the end of the book, our judges, everyone did what was right in his own eyes. And the danger there is not just that you try and hide what is wrong or justify what is wrong, but you actually shift the categories of right and wrong. You want to do it, it is therefore right. And once you've done that, not only do you give full range of instincts that have gone wrong, but also nobody the injustice, the deceit, the violence, the theft, the murder have no history. We look at our own society and we wonder why things are so badly wrong, so badly wrong. But instead of looking at society, let us look at ourselves and let's ask ourselves a very serious question. Is it really any different for us? In what sense do we hold ourselves truly, practically, on a day-to-day basis in terms of our speech, in terms of our thoughts, in terms of our thoughts, which Jesus tells us can be just as bad in terms of murder or adultery and our passions? In what sense are we practically speaking accountable
want to do it as we live. Isn't it the case that so often people justify their actions in spiritual terms after they've thought of doing them, or after they've done them? I'm sure the Lord wants to do it at a good time here. Yeah, I'm sure the Lord isn't bothered about this, I love you. Is it really any different from Israel? The shackles are off. The absolutes have gone. I am accountable only to my own desires.
But there's a third area which Israel was playing a lot of faults in, departing from the law in religion, in morality, and also in politics. Let me read to you chapter 7 from verse 11 to verse 16. Ephraim is like a dove, easily deceived and senseless, now calling to Egypt, now turning to Assyria. When they go, I will throw my net over them. I will pull them down like birds of the air. When I hear them flocking together, I will catch them. Woe to them because they have strayed from me. Destruction to them because they have rebelled against me. I long to redeem them, but they speak lies against me. They do not cry out to me from their hearts, but wail upon their beds. They gather together for grain and new wine, but turn away from me. I train them and strengthen them, but they have got evil against me. They do not turn to the Most High. They are like a faulty bow. Their leaders will fall by the sword because of their insolent words. For this they will be ridiculed in the land of Egypt. And what's going on? What's going on? What is all that talking about? Well, there was a problem facing Israel. We've already talked about a few, but there was another one. There was a rising threat away off to the northeast of a rapidly growing, tremendously powerful Assyrian empire based in Nineveh, but spreading hugely and ferociously across and down into the territory of Israel occupying. This rising threat, this growing army, this growing political force pushing its way nearer and nearer and nearer. Fundamental mistake politically that Israel made was, if you like, really a spiritual one. They made a wrong diagnosis. They diagnosed their problem merely as having to do with political power mongering. Or they diagnosed their problem as simply having to do with armies and military might. So you approach the problem by having bigger armies and better ones. Or else they had approached the problem as a challenge to return to a political and, if you like, imperial splendor that there was in political, military, and economic terms under King David. Back to the golden days of the past. Let's go and whop a few foreigners so that we can really extend our borders again. What was wrong in the diagnosis was a spiritual abandonment of God. They kept God out of the political picture. They kept God out of the problem. They failed to see that their political insecurity was a direct result of their spiritual infidelity. A direct result. It was their relationship with God that had gone so wrong that made them so weak as a people. So they diagnosed the problem wrongly, and then they did the next thing that you do when you made a wrong diagnosis: you prescribe a wrong solution, a wrong treatment. A series of attempted alliances. First of all, with Egypt down to the south. Imagine God's people who have been rescued from Egypt in Exodus now turning back to make an alliance with him against him. Imagine bitter anger. A bitterness felt by God, most people. First of all, an alliance with Egypt. That's what Hosea is talking about. Now calling to Egypt. And I'm in verse 11 there. But when the alliance that they made with Egypt didn't work, then they tried to sort of parley, as it were, with Assyria. and form a kind of alliance with them.
So the people
engaging, the kings, the leaders engaging in this frantic, chaotic, and ultimately humiliating series of attempted alliances to oppose Assyria and to appease Assyria. Now the problem, what was wrong with the political, was not whether they should have been pro-Assyria or pro-Egypt. The problem was that they were not being pro-Assyria. Unrighteousness had brought the nation down. We have politicians today who will prescribe a blueprint. A blueprint for our nation, and a blueprint for morality. But there is no politician in the land who can give the people the power, the ability to follow the blueprint. Only God can do that. There are all sorts of temptations for the church to form unholy alliances with the world, to increase its numbers, to make itself more credible. So the church begins to sell a commodity instead of proclaiming Christ. So the church begins to resemble the world only as sure as the media. So that the church forms alliances with the world that it was called out of in a spiritual excess. It is a temptation that we face all the time. We are in the world, but not on it. And sometimes, when we look at the things that are done, the techniques that are employed, the mentality, the philosophy behind approaches that are made to things like church growth or church use of money, then we have to ask ourselves, are we not more involved than we ever should be? Morally, and both of those because religiously, people that claim God false. And you know the most chilling thing about it is that they actually have to be taught. That is what I find most disturbing of all about these chapters. It's not the frank, explicit language it's used. It's not even the depravity within the nation. You're not to be surprised that God had forewarned. It is the fact that they actually had to be taught. There had to be a Hosea to stand up in front of these people and from God shouting, "What do you think you are doing? Open your eyes. Wake up. Look at how far you have gone." Sin brings its own blindness. People were blind. Their guides were blind too. It needed Hosea. The devil is brilliant. Staggeringly inventive at blinding God's people to what he is selling. Be not deceived. God is not mad. Whatsoever man shall sow, that shall be also reaped. Paul wrote that to a New Testament church, and he wrote it to them. And then, Hosea preached against the people, saying, "You are sowing the wicked, you are reaping the wicked." There is no substitute. There is no religious, moral, or political. or in a fortnight's time, we begin to look at the love of God and the future starts getting brighter. Let's close by singing together hymn 494. In 494, all for a closer walk with God, a calm and heavenly frame, a light to shine upon the road that leads me to the land.